Dapper, darling, dames, and darths, welcome to Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. This is episode 69, and of course, I am your humble host, Karen, and we are your Voltron of vocal voracious volunteers.
Ooh, I'm Colin.
I'm Dana.
I'm Chris. Did you say darth?
Yeah, what's a darth?
Oh, as in like Vader?
Oh, okay.
Maul?
Yeah.
Sidious.
Yeah, okay. Garden variety Darth.
Sure, sure.
You know, a Darth.
Yeah.
And today's show is brought to you by our brainy bookish buddy, Audible. Audible houses over 10,000 audiobooks ranging from bestsellers to classics, and of course some of our favorite books about trivia, weird facts, and secret histories. And we have definitely shared our picks in the past in previous episodes. So if you have never listened to any audiobooks, now's your chance. Visit audiblepodcast.com/goodjobbrain for your free audiobook download. And without further ado, let's jump into our general trivia segment, Pop Quiz Hotshot. And here I have a random Trivial Pursuit card, and you guys have your buzzers. Let's jump into answering some questions. All right. Blue Wedge for geography. What two Ivy League universities are located in New York State? Chris.
Cornell?
Ding, 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 ding.
Right.
Brown? No.
No.
That's in Rhode Island. What is the other Ivy League?
Oh, come on.
NY... Oh, it's
no,
Columbia.
Columbia.
Columbia. Oh,
Columbia.
Yeah.
New York City. All right. Pink Wedge for pop culture. Oh, boy. On the cover of Nirvana's album Nevermind, what is the underwater baby reaching for?
Oh,
everybody.
A dollar bill.
A dollar bill.
On a fish hook, right?
Yeah.
Yep. A donut. Oh, wait, I'm sorry.
That's Weird Al.
Oh, yeah, yes.
All right, Yellow Wedge. Who was the target of a CIA assassination plot that included a booby-trapped seashell and contaminated cigar? Colin.
I believe that was Fidel Castro.
Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. That sounds crazy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I didn't know about the booby-trapped seashell.
I haven't heard of the seashell. Yeah, I think I've heard of the exploding or poison or whatever cigar.
All right, Purple Wedge. What short-lived magazine was co-founded by Dave Eggers?
Oh, wait. Short-lived. Doesn't he do McSweeney's?
Yeah.
But that's still around.
Not McSweeney's. That is still around.
Yeah.
Was he part of Spy?
I've never heard of this.
What is it?
Mite.
Mite?
Yeah. Huh. M-I-G-H-T. Who knew?
Okay.
All right, Green Wedge for science. What sign language speaking gorilla famously befriended and cared for a kitten in the 80s? Dana.
Coco.
Coco.
It was
so cute.
It was just her birthday the other day.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Coco.
All right, last question, Orange Wedge. What is the primary ingredient in tofu?
Oh,
everybody.
Soy.
Fermented soybeans.
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 Soybeans work.
Okay.
Good job, brains. What a
weird card.
A weird card.
Tofu to Nirvana to gorillas.
My favorite.
Exploding.
It's kind of 90s-ish.
Was it an exploding cigar?
It was a poison, right?
Contaminated.
Oh, contaminated.
Cigar.
I had heard exploding in the past, but contaminated kind of, makes more sense.
Yeah. Get smart. It seemed like a get smart.
It does. Yeah, you're right. Very get smart, right.
So we decided that this week we're going to dedicate the whole episode to music. Everything from old instruments to current pop music, to secrets, to other facts, and hopefully you guys will enjoy.
Let's go on a journey.
Oh,
back way before even the 1970s, back to
what?
Maybe the beginning of human history. There's a cave in Germany. It's called Hohlfels, which means hollow rock.
Oh.
Which means cave.
I was like, the hole I fell in.
Okay. That would be funny.
Yeah.
But this cave in recent years has been a literal treasure trove for archaeologists. In 2008, you may have actually seen this. A few years back, it was a statue called the Venus of Hohlfels. And it was basically a statue of a very, it was very small, handheld figural art of a busty woman with all of her various lady parts very clearly defined.
Sure. Your reaction is very
small and busty. And hell.
Radiocarbon dating put it at about anywhere between 35 to 40. Thousand years old.
Whoa.
And people are saying this is basically like this is right now the earliest known piece of figural art ever. A mere stone's throw, I mean just like a couple of like feet away from this, more recently in this same cave in Germany, they found the oldest known musical instrument, a flute.
Oh,
sounds like a happening club in there.
a lot happening in this cave.
Yeah.
Music and figural artwork. One of the hypotheses that's out there is that humans traveled along the Danube River east to west from Asia into Europe, and that's how humans got into Europe. Very debated hypothesis, but this cave is located along that path.
Oh, got it.
So it's said that the findings in this cave, the extremely old early human artifacts, kind of support that hypothesis. Mm. So this is what the BBC said about the flute. It was made from a vulture's wing bone, a griffin vulture's wing bone.
Oh, whoa.
20 centimeters long with 5 finger holes and V-shaped notches on the end, which they assume the player would blow into.
Mm.
And the team that found it said this to the BBC at the time, "Music could have contributed to the maintenance of larger social networks and thereby perhaps have helped facilitate the demographic and territorial expansion of modern humans relative to a culturally more conservative Neanderthal population."
Hmm.
So music, people, humans, all getting together and playing music with each other might have fostered more bonds. And so being able to play vulture bone flutes might have been what caused humans to get up one over Neanderthals and caused Neanderthals to go extinct.
Take that, Neanderthals.
Wouldn't you think that the first musical instrument would be more like percussion based?
Well, if you want to get super technical about it, the first musical instrument would have been like the human voice, probably. Right.
Well, yeah,
and then rocks being banged together. But this is the first like
intentional,
that you can item that was created just to make music,
or that survived this long.
That's true,
right? Yeah, because you could probably just beat on rocks with sticks.
They might even put hides across like a hollowed out log or something. But it's all organic material.
That's true.
And it goes away.
It deteriorates. Mm-hmm. That's true. That's a good point.
Well, let's go from music made among rocks to rock music. I need a laugh track sometimes. So we're all fans of the Beatles. We've talked about them before, I think, many times on the show and in pub quiz.
If you can study one band.
Yes, yeah. If you have to study one band for pub quiz, right.
Yep.
Quintessential pub
know
quiz
the
band. Yep.
Yeah.
Know the Beatles.
That's
all
true.
The little secrets, the names, all that stuff.
So one of my favorite Beatles songs is Rain. You guys know the song Rain?
Mm-hmm. Nope.
It was a single. It was an advanced single off of Revolver. So it came out in 1966, and it was a non-album single, meaning it only existed as a single, but it was from the same sessions as Revolver. And, this was a period in time when the Beatles were feeling particularly experimental with a lot of their music, and John Lennon in particular, out of the Beatles, was really interested in just new, funky ways of recording. And one of the claims to fame for Rain, the song, is that it is considered generally one of the first rock songs to use backmasking. And do you guys know what backmasking is?
Recording something and then playing it backwards?
Yeah, more or less. But it's essentially recording something and then adding it onto a track backward so that when you play the track,
the Missy Elliott song.
Yeah,
exactly. That's a very well-known example is the Missy Elliott song. Okay. During the sessions for Revolver and Rain in particular, they had been playing around with backward instrumentation. So John Lennon, the story goes, by his own telling, it was at the end of a day, he was listening to some of the recording sessions, and he put the loop from Rain in, and either accidentally or maybe semi on purpose played it backwards, and was just really enthralled with the way it sounded. He's like, "This is just great. It's funky. It's something new." So let me just play a little snippet of the song here for you. So this is the last few seconds of Rain.
Interesting. It sounds like they're singing in English.
Doesn't sound backwards.
Right.
It just sounds weird, but it doesn't sound like...
No, I've gone ahead and reversed it, by which I mean played it forward. Would you guys like to hear that?
Yeah.
All right. So that was pretty much it, kind of just a little throwaway fun effect, but is considered the first example of a rock song putting back masking it.
I've heard of this trick before, but I didn't know that it was this song was the first one.
People, you know, certainly avant-garde artists had sort of experimented with music and things, but this is sort of the first pop
mainstream
rock song.
Yeah.
Right. So flash forward a couple years, and if you're a Beatles fan or a trivia fan, you may be aware of the Paul is Dead conspiracy theory, which was an idea that got in the heads of some fans that Paul McCartney had been killed in a car accident,
yes,
and was replaced by a fake Paul, an imposter Paul. And more specifically, the theory was that the Beatles were dropping hints about this in their songs.
And album artwork, everywhere.
The fact that Paul is not wearing shoes walking across the street on the cover of Abbey Road.
Right, or that he's the only one turned away from you on Sgt. Pepper's and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Right, and one of the really strong pieces of evidence that people latched onto is that off of Revolution 9, you can hear back masking versions of Turn Me On Dead Man, Turn Me On Dead Man, which is supposed to be John Lennon's, you know, sort of admission to the listeners that Paul is dead. And you can go find the sample, and I think it's a great example of if you want to hear it, you can hear it.
Yeah.
And the Beatles, of course, Paul was not dead. They denied this. So this was sort of one of the first examples, though, of people starting to look for sort of nefarious messaging in records.
Satanic messaging.
So that's what I would like to talk to you guys about.
Satanic messaging.
Fad isn't even the right word, but the mania that
hysteria.
Thank you. The hysteria over hidden satanic messages that swept America in the late 70s and early 80s. This is, you know, moving into the late 70s now, this was when people started really getting interested in subliminal advertising, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, and particularly there's a guy named Brian Key, and he's the guy you've probably seen who was convinced that the word sex appeared in ads everywhere. Mm. You know, his idea is that if you put the word sex hidden in an ad for soda or crackers, that people will form a subliminal association and they'll want to buy that brand. No one legitimately really believes this who's actually studied it. They've not been able to show any connection between subliminal messaging, whether it is or isn't there. But it is a good example of you see what you want to see. In the 70s, there were a lot of conservative Christian groups and conservative parents groups that were starting to get concerned of hidden evil messages in rock music. And in particular, there was a DJ named Michael Mills, and he went on a crusade to convince people that Stairway to Heaven, okay?
Uh-huh. Yes,
the famous
classic.
Led Zeppelin classic song. This was his token great example of hidden satanic messages. That Stairway to Heaven, if you played it backwards, there was a patch that said, "Here's to my sweet Satan." And let me play this for you guys very, very quickly. And here's the segment in question played forward.
Yes, there are two paths you can go by, but in the long.
Oh, that's my favorite part of the song.
Yeah, perfectly normal, right? Yeah. All right, so here's that segment reversed. So in his ears, it is as clear as day that they are singing, "Here's to my sweet Satan."
Sure, and when you combine it with what the words are that it's intended to be, you will hear that because of the power of suggestion of the words being there.
Right, right.
It's like by chance. I don't know.
Well, yeah. So Michael Mills, and there was another big figure, there was Pastor Gary Greenwald of California, and they basically took up the torch for spreading the message that rock music, this insidious message, is getting inside our children's heads, and they would go on tours and speaking tours. Pastor Greenwald would hold record burnings. You know, you have just like a mass record burning and come out and just trash those evil satanic records. This wasn't just sort of a fringe belief. I mean, this really bubbled up.
It's bad. I wish it were true because it would be awesome to embed secret codes in music. Like if you could say words forwards and backwards and they had different meanings, but it's not true.
It's completely impossible to actually do that.
I wish. I mean,
Completely.
If we could design language again, maybe we would have done that, where you could say
it. Say whatever. One thing backwards and would say one thing forward.
It's like an auditory
palindrome. That's creature feedback, actually.
No.
Yeah.
Wait, so that's my question. Are there any auditory palindromes that the way that you say it is the same word?
I'm sure.
I don't know any.
I wonder if it works as the same way as, rotor.
Yeah, there you go.
You know what? Would it, though? Because there's like a different noise at the beginning. That
no one had really done any serious research on the two things of like, one, can your brain actually understand something that's being said backward? Right. And then, and then two, if your brain does understand it, can it influence behavior?
Then,
right, exactly.
I need to try poop.
You should. It's a lot of fun.
Just play it backwards. Here I am.
Okay, I'm going to say poop normal. Poop. I'm going to insert backwards poop. Oof. Here it is.
In the 1980s, they undertook an actual study of this phenomenon. Can we play backward encoded messages for people, and are they intelligible? And what they found is no. They did find that it's just a very human phenomenon to want to make things intelligible. And that, as you say, you can kind of hear some words in there. What they also found, though, is that people would only hear the supposed satanic messages if they were primed ahead of time. They would only hear them if they said, all right, we want you to listen and see if you can hear this. But basically, it was no better than chance otherwise, if they heard anything. And then secondarily, they found no influence of hearing these messages on your actual behavior. Here's where it gets just crazy for me. Now, I want to remind you, all right, this is 1980s, okay? The state legislature of California passed a bill that stated distributing material that contains backward messages without public notice is an invasion of privacy. Opened up the distributor to lawsuits. This is the state of California legislature passed this bill.
So I know Prince has a song, Darling Nikki, and at the end of it, there's a section he's singing backwards. Did they have to put out a notice saying that there's backwards
I
music?
I guess he would have been arrested in California. Right? Well, I'm not sure.
But by all the research I can do, it seems that there were actually no teeth to any of these various pieces of legislation. But, you know, I mean, like a lot of politicians, you want to grandstand and pass them. But still, the state of Arkansas, all right, this one goes even further. In Arkansas, they passed a bill, and now this is verbatim. They had to place stickers on records and tapes that say, warning, this record contains backward masking, which may be perceptible at a subliminal level when the record is played forward.
That makes me want to buy it.
I think like a lot of things, like if all you're going to do is just, if you make something seem forbidden, kids are going to want to have it more.
Yeah.
In the one like happy little twist to this story again. So this was passed by the Arkansas legislature. It went to the governor's desk for approval. And it was vetoed and sent back by Governor Bill Clinton.
Oh, wow.
Yes, in a moment of clarity. So thank you, Bill, at a 30-year remove.
You know what's funny is...
Because he'd be like, what is this?
Because he loved Led Zeppelin, probably.
But Gore's wife was responsible for...
Yes, that's right.
The tipper sticker.
The Parents Resource Music Council, which started in 1985 and was very, very heavily born out of this hysteria. Mm-hmm. Like, they came into being and one of their first goals was seeing, are there really hidden satanic messages in our rock music?
Yep. Man, people are bored.
You know, people are bored and maybe a little...
they want to help you, protect you.
It died down for a bit. They said one of the reasons that the hysteria died down was because as people moved away from records into CDs, it wasn't as easy to play things backwards. And there are people out there who still really, really believe that the Church of Satan is actively working with rock bands to put their messages in their songs.
I wonder how much that sponsorship is.
Yeah. No, have they been approached yet for backwards? Satan advertising?
in the pocket of big Satan. So the moral of the story is you hear what you want to hear.
Yep. That's true. Yeah. That's true. I promise you guys I am going to talk about music, but it's going to be a weird twisty way of getting there. But I'm going to start off by asking you guys this question. Do you know what the Ferris wheel is called in some Latin American countries, like in Costa Rica and Chile?
I do not.
I don't. No.
Some people call it the Rueda de Chicago, which means Chicago wheel.
Really?
Okay.
And the reason why is because the original Ferris wheel made by Mr. Ferris, George Ferris.
Sure.
The first Ferris wheel was at the Chicago World's Fair.
Ah.
Okay.
And that was in 1893, or it was also called the World's Columbian Exposition. It was to celebrate the 400th anniversary of Christopher Columbus' arrival into the New World. Really, really big deal. And I think the idea to me of a World's Fair is pretty awesome. Just these long-running expos featuring different countries, showcasing culture and history and exoticism, architecture, and lots of like innovation and vision of the future, and a lot of notable firsts. This fair, this particular fair, was so big in scale and so grand that it easily far exceeded all the other world fairs at that point, and it really became a symbol of America and, you know, that time. So in addition to the Ferris wheel debut, Juicy Fruit Gum also debuted. Pabst Blue Ribbon, PBR, debuted at the World's Fair. In a lot of these fairs, they have international pavilions, right? Different countries have their showcase. So Spain, they had a showcase. They recreated the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, the ships. There was also an Egyptian attraction called A Street in Cairo. You know, so they had snake charmers and music and dancers, and this is where belly dancing was introduced to the world, even though belly dancers were not really Egyptian at all.
Right.
But you know, when you watch cartoons, you see snake charmers and stuff. They play songs on the flute and the snake comes coes out. That song, there's that song, quintessential snake charmer. That was improvised. A man named Saul Bloom, who was running the show, later became an American politician. He was said to have come up with that quintessential snake charmer song. Yep. And he didn't copyright it, so it went into public domain. That's why you hear it everywhere.
Of course, yeah. A place in France where the naked ladies dance.
I read that in my research, but I was like, I have no idea what this record is doing.
Kids sing it on the playground.
There's a place in France where the naked ladies dance.
Another rest.
The next refrain I always heard was, and the men don't care, they just throw their underwear.
Which didn't make sense to me, but like you don't question on
the playground. Listen, when you're getting laughs on the playground, you're
it's a little bit naughty.
Good. Right.
And that song was made famous because of the Chicago's World Fair.
Wow.
Yeah. And in addition to all of this, all the spectacle and the marvel, there was a lot of idea exchange and seminars, and it's not just flashy stuff. This was the turn of the century, and people and experts were really involved in showcasing new ideas and new methodology, including the idea of education for children. So I want to introduce to you guys a very special lady. Her name is Patty Hill, and she's one of the key figures in shaping the foundation for the modern kindergarten we have today in America. She was an educator, and she was at the Chicago World's Fair representing her branch of experimental schooling for young kids, and she was the principal for the Louisville Experimental Kindergarten School. So what was the big difference between her, you know, method and previous methods? She really saw importance of the idea of playing and pretend play in classrooms to facilitate learning. She felt that children needed to socialize and free play to develop kind of and explore the world around them. So, you know, when you go see, like, in a kindergarten classroom, you see, like, toy cars and play money and little kitchen sets and big blocks and stuff. Like, it's thanks to her and thanks to her push. She thought that maybe having pretend play that kids will work together more, they'll cooperate, they'll
rather
move
than
around.
Just sitting them down and
they'll move around more. And she also saw the importance of using songs and music in classrooms. So Patty and her sister Mildred was also a kindergarten teacher, and they came up with songs. And one notable song they coined was called Good Morning to All. And they would sing this song, a simple greeting song to welcome students to class every day. Now, you may know the song, of course, under a different name.
You may know the melody a little bit better.
Yep. Yeah. And this is definitely the most performed song and most recognized song in the entire world. Can you guess what song it is?
Happy birthday song.
Yay!
Now, unlike the dee-dee-dee-dee-dee guy, Patty Hill and her sister actually got it copyrighted.
Yeah. So, yes, Good Morning to All, in fact, was published in songbooks, but the trail gets muddy in terms of when the lyrics Happy Birthday to You was revamped. By the mid-1930s, the birthday song had appeared in Broadway musicals and TV shows, radio shows, and it became a thing. And, of course, this point was when Jessica Hill, the third Hill sister, kind of sprang up and filed a copyright suit.
Oh, really?
They're like, wait a minute. This Happy Birthday song that's appearing everywhere is using the same exact melody.
Yes.
100%.
Right.
And she was able to secure the copyright of Happy Birthday to You for her sister and her family
okay.
in 1934.
Okay, right. So they already had the copyright for Good Morning to All, but they were able to essentially get Happy Birthday to You folded into
covered
that.
Covered under that.
Yes.
Because everybody was using it.
Right.
So due to copyright laws and weird extension rules and whatnot, the Happy Birthday song will not pass into the public domain until 2030.
Right. Wow. At the earliest. Right.
At the earliest.
Because as we know with a lot of copyright laws,
they might,
like, they might change the law to extend the copyright, yeah, et cetera.
So we actually all heard this rumor. They're like, oh, Happy Birthday is actually not public domain.
Right.
You're not allowed.
Right.
Yeah. That is true. That is definitely true.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen at the end of credits in movies, you'll see, you know, the birthday song, whatever, copyright.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
And if you go to like a small restaurant, like a family owned restaurant, and you have a birthday, maybe they'll come out and sing Happy Birthday to you illegally.
Yeah.
However, but if you ever go to like a big chain restaurant,
Chili's,
like a TGI Fridays or whatnot, they will have their own birthday song, a special birthday song that they sing, because they, as a big company, don't want to get in trouble.
So, the Darden Group, the restaurant group that owns Red Lobster and Olive Garden, required every one of their restaurants, the different restaurant chains that they own, to have their own special birthday song so they would not infringe the copyright. I mean, so what does this mean? That, like, does everybody who sings Happy Birthday to you at parties is infringing or doing it illegally?
No.
Well, it's something around public performance.
Exactly.
Royalties are due when you're using the song for commercial uses. So, like you said, in movies, in TV, singing it for profit, in shows, incorporate into items. So if you have like those musical greeting cards that you open up, have to pay licensing fees for that. Public performance, definitely. So any performance which occurs, quote, at a place open to the public or at any place where a substantial number of persons outside of a normal circle of a family and its social acquaintances is gathered.
Right. So
restaurants, arenas, sport complex.
And now, who owns the rights, though, now? It's not the family anymore. It's like some giant media conglomerate that owns the rights now, right?
Warner Music.
Okay, right.
Well, an investment group that owns Warner Music, Warner/Chappell. And the company, back in 1988, paid $25 million to acquire a small company whose musical holdings included the birthday song. I don't think they cared about all the other songs.
I'm willing to guess they didn't.
It was for the birthday song.
Yep, $25 million for the birthday song.
Yep.
And it has been reported that to use the Happy Birthday song in a film, they charge up to $10,000.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Television shows, $700 per show. They collect approximately $2 million per year just for a Happy Birthday song. That's for existing. $2 million a year. And so, because of the copyright issues, filmmakers rarely show the complete sing-along, or they just sub in for He's a Jolly Good Fellow, because that is public domain.
Yep.
So they void the song entirely. Mm. And for clever shows, a lot of clever shows out there, they would sing Happy Birthday song that's kind of like the birthday song, but not really. And I'm going to play one for you guys.
What day is today? It's Nibbler's birthday. What a day for a birthday. Let's all have some cake.
And you smell like one, too.
That was, of course, from Futurama.
Close, but no cigar.
Yeah, sounds really close. Thank you for taking this journey with me, starting from the Chicago World's Fair to the Happy Birthday song. But yeah, actually, the World's Fair stuff, super interesting, super, super interesting.
So have you read a book called Devil in the White City?
Yes. So this is my segue into our sponsorship break, actually. The Devil in the White City by Eric Larson is an awesome, awesome book. And
yes,
it's available on Audible as an audiobook. And it's about the craziness of the Chicago World's Fair, like of the scandal, I mean, of the triumph of every little nitty gritty, lots of trivia bits here.
Yeah. But it's also true crime.
Yeah.
Crazy pants true crime.
It's, yeah. It's really compelling. That would be one of my big Audible picks.
It's like this guy built a murder mansion in Chicago or near Chicago. Huh. People come into town for the World's Fair. God, it was crazy.
So don't listen to this audiobook at night, is what you're saying.
You can.
Or do so.
There was a lot of other stuff. It was like at some trivia. Fest.
Oh, okay.
It's like the triumph and tragedy of the World's Fair.
So yes, actually, speaking of Audible, I know a lot of listeners have been writing in asking us to list all the books we've been recommending and put it somewhere on the site. It is now on the site. You can go to the site and you'll see in the navigation, it'll say book club, and then you can see all of our recs. Man, we had a lot.
With hyperlinks.
Yes, with hyperlinks. So try it out, and you also will get your free audiobook download if you visit audiblepodcast.com/goodjobbrain. So check it out, and finally, I've put all of our recommendations together.
Sweet. Oh, that's great. I need a new book.
Yeah.
And I've been putting off learning how to read, so this just, this helps. This really, well, this helps.
It doesn't help you read. It helps you put it off longer. Yeah. I have a music-related quiz for you guys.
Yay!
It's called Rock on TV, and it has to do with rock stars and TV scandals.
Oh.
All right.
What does that mean?
Well, let's
I don't know, but
see.
I got my buzzer.
All right. Your buzzer's ready. All right. First question. These two rock stars with the same first name were both reported to have thrown TV sets out of the hotel window.
Oh.
Out of the same hotel's window, but in different rooms. Chris.
Elvis Presley and Elvis Costello.
Nope.
Dang.
Oh, God, I thought it was going to be like Oasis or something.
These were maybe the first rock stars who ever done that or started the whole like meme of rock stars throwing TVs out of hotels.
Was one of them the Beatles?
Hot mess in the 60s.
Hot mess.
Nope. Well, no Beatles.
No Beatles.
Jim.
You guys give up?
Jerry.
No. Gene.
I give up.
Keith Richards and
Keith Moon.
Keith Moon. Both threw the television sets out of the same hotel in LA. Do you know what the name of the hotel was? I guess not. It's the Hyatt on Sunset or the Continental Hyatt.
Wow.
Is this still there?
It's still there. It was in Almost Famous. It shows up in a lot of TV shows.
Two TVs, yes.
Yeah. Two windows, two different rooms. They both did it.
I wonder if they have a little plaque or something. It'd be interesting. I would just
a lot of crazy things happen in that hotel. You should check out the Wikipedia entry. Elvis Presley got the nickname Elvis the Pelvis after appearing on what TV show?
Oh.
Colin.
I think that was Ed Sullivan's show, right?
No.
Oh.
Really?
Nope.
Oh, hold on. Oh, God, I remember seeing the black and white.
Yeah. What's the Ed, oh, yeah, the Beatles.
I bet they didn't show him on
was
the...
Was it on the Dick
Bandstand?
Cavett show? What was it?
Oh,
was it
American Bandstand?
Nope.
No, y'all think it was...
It was the Milton Berle show.
Oh, really?
Do you guys know what song he was singing?
I'm Boots all shook shoes. Up.
It was You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog. Yeah. I watched a video this morning on YouTube, and I'm like, yeah, sure. There was some pelvis shaking. I could see where the name came from. Ed Sullivan did famously try not to show him dancing in that way from the waist up.
Right, right.
But just when he was doing the dance, they did above the waist.
Not that racy.
It's not that. I mean,
not that racy.
It would have curled his hair if he could see what people do now. Speaking of controversial TV appearances, Sinead O'Connor was the center of this controversy after appearing on Saturday Night Live for doing what?
Everybody ripping up a picture of the Pope.
Rage Against the Machine was banned from ever appearing on Saturday Night Live.
Really?
They were scheduled to do two songs, but only ended up doing one. Do you know why?
They tore up a picture of Sinead O'Connor.
No.
Is it because they... profanity?
No. They wanted to hang the American flag upside down on their speakers. And during dress rehearsal, they were told they weren't able to do that. And then the moment before they were cutting to them to perform,
they did it anyway.
The roadies were trying to hang it up, and then there was like a scuffle, and they were able to, they ripped it down. And then after their performance, they said, you have to leave the building right now.
Wow, yeah.
And that's why they didn't get to say goodnight at the end, and they were banned from performing on Saturday Night Live.
Which I'm sure they actually wore as a badge
just
of pride.
Just from a professionalism standpoint.
Yeah.
Ashley Simpson had a calamitous appearance on Saturday Night Live.
Yes.
When her lip sync track started for the wrong song.
Yes.
What song started playing?
I don't know.
Oh, man. Okay.
So, Frank Sinatra's Luck Be a Lady.
No.
I couldn't play. Name any Ashley Simpson song.
What was
song?
Her hit at
Autobiography,
that time?
Shadow of Me.
So Autobiography was the one that she was supposed to start singing.
Holy moly.
I'm trying to see if Karen's going to retrieve it.
Oh, God.
This was a question for Karen.
What was it?
Pieces of Me.
Of Me. Okay.
Madonna's commercial for what soda company enraged Catholics?
I think it was Pepsi.
Yep.
Pepsi. What song?
That was Like a Prayer, right? Yeah.
People were upset because there were a lot of religious overtones. She had the stigmata. She made out with a saint. Do you guys know which saint she was making out with in that video?
Sebastian?
The guy, I know it was the guy from Cool Runnings. I don't know what saint he was. Basil?
Saint Runnings.
Saint Runnings. Saint Jamaica.
Martin de Porres, who is the patron saint of mixed people.
Really?
Yes.
There is a saint for mixed people. Yeah. I guess there is a saint for everything.
And he was the saint of racial harmony and mixed race people. Huh. Well. Yeah. Okay. Justin Timberlake and Janet Jackson stirred up controversy with their infamous wardrobe malfunction during the 2004 Super Bowl. What song were they performing? When the malfunction happened.
Jeez.
Oh, man.
Am I lucky enough for it to be Nasty Boys?
I know the line, right? The line is like, I'll have you naked by the end of this song.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Rock your body.
Rock your body.
Way.
Yes.
Oh, good job. Hey.
Thank you, Colin.
Teamwork.
Wow.
Which teams played during that Super Bowl?
Oh, man. Patriots and the Rams.
Yeah.
The Panthers.
Patriots and Panthers.
Patriots and Panthers.
Pasty, Panthers, Patriots. That's how you remember it.
Yeah, it got real conservative after that. It was
like a lot of
Paul McCartney. Yeah. And
you too. Yeah.
People who do not have wardrobe malfunctions on stage.
Or if they did, it wouldn't be a big deal.
Wait a minute. Yes, it would. YouTube or Paul McCartney had a wardrobe malfunction. Anyway, good job, you guys.
Wow, thanks. So we've been talking about some things that have happened during the history of music. So I'm going to take you back in time again. Now I finally get to play musical segments. Huh?
Oh!
I am going to kick this off by playing a musical clip, and I would like you, someone, to buzz in and identify this speaker. Tell me who is speaking in this clip.
All right.
The first words I spoke in the original phonograph. A little piece of practical poetry. Mary had a little lamb, its fleece was white as snow, and everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go.
Colin?
Is that Thomas Edison?
That is Thomas Alva Edison, the man himself. He was speaking on the 50th anniversary of the phonograph, the sound recording and playback device that he invented. It was the year 1927 when he was speaking. Edison's phonograph was the first device that could record a sound, and then you could play it back and listen to it again. Basically, what would happen, right, is you'd have like a membrane or a really tightly stretched diaphragm, which would vibrate when sounds hit it. It was essentially sort of like our eardrums, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Vibrates, it's attached to a stylus or, you know, a very fine kind of needle, which would then vibrate, and then it would etch the sound moving up and down on a piece of tin foil that was wrapped around a cylinder.
Right.
And then you could take that piece of tin foil and essentially reverse the process and recreate the sound.
That's how it works.
Using the tinfoil to vibrate the needle. Yeah, well, that's how a record player works. You know, it's just a groove that vibrates a needle.
No, but to record it.
Oh, yeah.
And then to play it back again.
It vibrates in the same way, but it etches it into the tinfoil. Now, this was actually, I just found out, preceded by another device that also recorded sound. And it was invented in 1857. By a guy named Edouard Leon Scott de Martinville, and it was called the phonoautograph, or sound automatic writer. Edouard Leon Scott de Martinville, Leo Scott, as I'm going to call him for the rest of this, he was actually writing on, though, instead of tinfoil, was a sheet of soot-covered paper.
Ah.
So you'd take that paper and just sort of lightly trace a line in it with the vibrations of the stylus.
It turns white.
Right. Scott was not trying to play any of this stuff back. He wanted to study sound visually.
Mm.
He wanted to be able to look at what sound looked like.
Quantify it somehow.
Right. So the phonoautograph, the reason we don't talk about this dude today is because, you know, you didn't play anything back.
So what?
It was just sort of recording sound, which is cool. In 2008, a group of scholars, university professors, were able to reconstruct some of the phonautographs digitally. They used it was a virtual stylus. They scanned the image. They got really, really nice versions of the graphing, you know, of the sounds, and they followed the path of the stylus digitally and then created sound waves out of that. Now, this should have actually been impossible since the phonautograph was hand-cranked, which means that there would have been a lot of differences in speeds and, yeah, variations, and actually that really should have rendered these recordings unproducible because you don't know what the tone is supposed to be. But Scott actually thought ahead with this and did something really clever with his later recordings, which is he included a reference tone. So for all of the recordings that he recorded, while they were doing this, he would play in another recorder one constant tone
so that you could calibrate it again.
Exactly. So that they can then go back to the ones that have reference tones. So here is one of those recordings, a man, almost surely Scott himself, singing a vocal scale. This sound you're hearing is from the year 1860.
Wow.
This is one of the very, very earliest recordings we have of a human voice. And he gets a little faster towards the end because he knows his time is about to run out because he only has so much paper. So he rushes the last note there.
Wow.
Yeah. And there's
other
ones.
And he never intended for the, I mean,
to play that. Oh, he didn't think anybody was going to ever hear this. So yeah, yeah, it was write only and no reading. Now, as I said, we do not have Thomas Edison's original recording of Mary Had a Little Lamb yet. I mean, maybe somebody's going to find it. But it is believed that what I'm about to play for you guys right now is the first recording on an Edison-style metal cylinder that was ever something that he intended to actually sell to the public. And this is something that would have been included in a proposed, an idea for a talking doll.
Huh. Can you tell what that...
Now, I'm sorry for turning this into, like, a horror film.
What?
Can you tell what that was?
Satan is my lord.
my dear sweet Satan.
Here's to my sweet Satan.
Can you tell what that was?
I can't make it out into the static.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. Well, I'll tell you what it is. It's Twinkle Twinkle Little Star.
Oh.
Now, Edison wanted to create talking dolls that would say Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. And he had the method by which you could, you know, somebody would speak into a cone and it would vibrate the diaphragm and record a metal cylinder. But there was no technology at this point to make copies of this.
Oh, got it.
Edison hired, apparently, two women to be in this recording studio, essentially, the first, essentially, professional recording studio. Oh. And these women were, of course, the first professional paid recording voice actors, right?
Yeah.
Artists. And just say Twinkle Twinkle Little Star over and over and over again.
God.
Because every time they said it, they could create one cylinder for one doll. Every time you spoke it, that was one doll, and then you had to do it again for the next doll and again for the next doll. So they're in there 8 hours a day just saying Twinkle Twinkle Little Star.
Oh, I wish you got to see Teddy Ruxpin.
He would have been very pleased. Here's an actual piece of music, and I want you to try to identify the piece of music, and then to tell me, if you know, why this particular piece of music, or the larger work of music that this fits into, is important in the history of recorded music.
All right.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Waltz of the Flower by Tchaikovsky in the Nutcracker.
Yes, that's exactly right. Do you know what the Nutcracker suite, what sort of place of prominence it occupies in recorded musical history or trivia?
Ballet.
First orchestra. Stereo. Orchestra recording.
No. First complete set of records.
First duplicated or replicate.
Is it
Colin the, basically has it.
Is you this wanna... the first album?
Indeed.
Yes.
It's the 1908 recording by Odeon Records of the Nutcracker Suite in general is considered to be the first record album. Because instead of just buying one record, which has a couple of minutes of songs on each one, they did the whole Nutcracker Suite on four records, each of which was inserted into a sleeve, which is in a leather-bound album. Hence the phrase... a record album.
I was really hoping this was going to come up in the show today.
Hey.
Yeah.
That's why it's called an album. Right.
Yeah, like a photo album.
Now,
Never thought of that.
I'm going to play you two more clips. Let's keep in this mindset of famous milestones in the history of recorded music going into more modern times. Here is a clip, and I want you to tell me who did this piece of music and what relevance it has to the history or milestones in recorded music.
Because you had to be a big shot, didn't you? You had to open up your mouth. You had to be a big shot, didn't you? All your friends were so knocked out.
Colin?
Well, that's Billy Joel.
Sure is.
Big shot.
Yes.
Okay, just based on the time period, I'm going to guess, was this the first song recorded on a CD?
It was!
Oh, wow!
It was not the first song ever recorded on a CD, but Billy Joel's album 52nd Street, which began with the song Big Shot, was the first commercially released album on compact disc.
That's great.
October 1982 in Japan.
Huh.
The album itself is from 1978, but it was such a huge hit for Sony's, you know, music group.
That's definitely a pub quiz worthy question. Absolutely.
Here's something that's a little less pub quiz. I'm going to play one more track, and again, this is a more dubious honor, perhaps a more dubious distinction for this the album that this track was off. Maybe slightly embarrassing distinction is here. Dana.
Fleetwood Mac.
It is. It's Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah.
A song called No Questions Asked. Karen.
Most bootlegged song. Or pirated song.
No.
That would be something to be proud of.
First mini disc song.
Not first mini disc song. No. That would be dubious.
8-track?
What about it?
Last 8-track?
You are absolutely right.
Wow.
That was off of the album Fleetwood Mac's Greatest Hits. It was only on the Greatest Hits album as a bonus track. And Fleetwood Mac's Greatest Hits is considered to be released in November 1988, the last album released by a major label on 8-track.
What year did it say?
1988, November
88. That's really late for
8-track. At that point, you had to be ordering it like through a catalog, basically, because stores had generally stopped it. Now, we have a lot of children who listen to this podcast. Kids, an 8-track is, I guess, if you were to imagine,
like an old video game cartridge.
No, they don't know about that either.
I don't even know
something
what
the size of a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, but on thicker bread.
Right.
Plastic.
And the 8-track,
it's a cartridge.
It only went forwards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to go backwards, you couldn't. You just had to go to a different part of the tape and listen to those songs instead and then wait for the first part to come around. It was wildly inconvenient.
The advantage it had over cassettes, though, was that it had random access, meaning that you could jump, you know what I mean? Like, you could jump ahead to
you could press a button and jump to a section. Yes.
Chris was mentioning the Edison cylinders. The first ones were, in fact, you know, wrapped with tin around a core, and then they moved into wax. You know, early on, they were really focused on this as a tool for recording speech. You know, one thought they had is like, oh, maybe this could supplant handwritten letters. You know, you would dictate your letter and send the cylinder across and somebody would have, you know, putting it into talking dolls. You know, there was one of those things like, all right, we got this great technology. Now, how do we commercialize it?
Yep.
It was not very long before, hey, we can put music on these things. We can put music on them and sell them to people. One of the drawbacks in recording cylinders was that there was no means of mass production. If you wanted
three copies of something, you had to record it three times.
Yes.
If you wanted 50 copies of something, you had to sit and record it 50 times.
There's no control C in
control. And, you know, I mean, again, if you're using this as a replacement for letters, you know, fine, that's not big a deal. But if you want to put out Tchaikovsky or music, this is a problem.
You can't scale up.
Wow.
Now, you might think this doesn't seem very sustainable. Somebody's got to come up with a better solution than one person, one recorder. So, come around the 1890s, someone had the brilliant idea.
I know.
What would you do, Karen?
Well, you have the person performing, and you just surround them with a lot of
recorders. Oh, that's what they did. That was their solution.
Cram the room.
You would get the band or the singer, whoever, and you would literally set up as many phonograph recording devices as you could fit into the room.
Yeah.
You would coordinate them all blank. You would flip the switch. They all start at the same time, and the band would perform. The singer would sing, you know, and you might be able to record as many as a dozen at a time, right? So this was the solution for a surprisingly long time. Eventually, someone hit on the idea of using a pantograph. And if you guys know what a pantograph is from drawing, it's the cool device where you attach it to your pen, and there's a little stylus on the other end. And as you draw, it mirrors what you're drawing.
That's a real thing.
That's a real thing.
Drawing.
That's right. Pantograph.
Yes. I've seen it in cartoons where you write a letter and then there's like a weird R.
Right. But still, it wasn't really until, you know, the turn of the century that Edison and his factory, got to give him a little bit of credit here, they were one of the pioneers in really coming up with a reliable reproduction system, which is, it's very straightforward. It's, they would just make casts and molds. So they would still record the single master cylinder one way, coat it with metal, melt out the wax, and then you can cast new cylinders from the inside of that one. But I just thought the idea of them sitting in a little room with surrounded by a dozen blanks recording all at once. Okay, guys, take it again from the top. Oh, just shoot me, please. I do not want to play this again.
You have to wait for them to set it all up again, too.
Yeah, right.
Woo, boy. That was a long journey from the caves of Germany to Billy Joel.
That might be the longest time span we've covered in an episode.
Probably. So we got one last quiz segment. Colin, take it away.
Yes, I have a quiz for you guys called Let's Go to Work.
Sounds like the worst quiz.
I'm going to name for you guys a fictional workplace. So this may be a workplace as seen in a TV show or a movie or a book. Most of them are actually from TV. Tell me what setting it comes from. So, for example, if I were to say Dunder Mifflin.
The Office.
The Office. Exactly. Yeah. I think you guys get it. And we're going to do this one as a lightning round here. So I'll say it. Buzz in if you think you know it.
Okay.
Here we go. Get your buzzers ready. Strickland Propane.
What?
King of the Hill.
Yes.
Damn, Peggy.
Sterling Cooper.
This is Mad Men.
Yes. Pawtucket Brewery.
This is Family Guy.
Yes, it is Family Guy, where Peter, I believe, works in the later episodes.
Yep.
Wernham Hog.
This is British Office.
Yes. Can't get anything past Dana if it's on British TV. The Bluth Company.
Arrested Development.
Indeed. Initech.
Office Space.
Yes, Office Space.
Yes, yes, yes.
Michael Bolton et al.
Yeah. Your name is Michael Bolton.
I love his music.
The Lanford Lunchbox.
Oh.
Roseanne.
Indeed. Yeah. Ewing Oil.
Dallas.
Yep.
Oh, Jerry.
McDowell's.
I think this is Coming to America.
Yes.
They have the Golden Arches. I have the Golden Arch.
That was great.
They have the Big Mac. I have the Big Mick.
Bushwood Country Club.
Wow.
Caddyshack.
Indeed.
Oh, so good.
Zuckerman's Farm.
I believe this is Charlotte's Web.
Yes, it is.
Wow.
Charlotte's Web.
Oh, yes. Zuckerman's Pick.
The Weyland-Yutani Corporation. Yes.
Okay, well,
any one of the
Prometheus.
Yes.
The
aliens.
Oh, okay.
Right,
oh,
they're
okay.
The evil giant corporation that sends people out to die.
Oh,
cool.
The Shinehart Wig Company.
30 Rock.
Yes, the apparent company of NBC.
Yeah.
Spacely Space Sprockets.
The Jetsons.
It is the Jetsons. And their rival, do you know, for bonus...
Cogswell Cogs.
Yes, yeah. Cogswell
wow.
Cogs.
I watched a lot of cartoons when I was a little kid.
The Paper Street Soap Company.
Fight Club.
Yeah. Yes, Fight Club. The book and the movie.
We'll just call it the book to class it up a little bit.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, there's a movie of Fight Club? Sacred Heart Hospital.
Oh, it's Scrubs.
Yes, it is Scrubs. Sugar Baker Designs.
Oh!
Designing Daddy women.
Yes, designing women.
Why do we all see... Why do we all look at Chris?
He butts in first.
Yeah.
When I think Southern women, I think Chris Kohler.
Like, I'm a proud Southern woman.
She's smart.
The 4077th Mobile Army Surgical Hospital.
MASH.
Indeed. Yeah. Franken and Hire Architects.
Oh. Franken and Hire.
This is a literary.
Architects. Oh. Fountainhead.
Correct.
Oh. I was like, what book is about architecture?
Nice.
That one.
Close it out with my favorite fictional workplace.
All right.
You listed some good ones already, so I'm psyched.
Vandalay Industries.
Seinfeld.
It is Seinfeld. Yeah. This is George's fake company whenever he needs a fake employer. Good job, guys. I think you got every single one there. Yeah, yeah. Well done.
Well, that is our show. Thank you guys for joining me. Thank you guys, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learned a lot about fictional workplaces, but more importantly, our big journey of music from the caves of Germany to the 8-tracks, to scandals on TV, to the Chicago World's Fair, to Happy Birthday, everything. A lot. Covered a lot.
Yeah.
And you can find us on iTunes, on Stitcher, on SoundCloud, and also our website, goodjobbrain.com. And check out our sponsor, Audible. And we also have our page up, so now you can see our book recommendations. And yeah, we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye.
What's your name, my friend? Any silver or your sheep?